It's quite amazing. You don't really forget it if you go to an extreme remote part of vast Alaska's coastline and find that there's junk all over it. But it's happened. Stuff that floated there, stuff that's lost at sea, run down some open sewer in some far-off open urban area. It may not be the Alaska we want, but this is the Alaska we've got. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. What is our role here? Garbage collectors? Call toll-free 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. Gyre, an international exhibition of art related to the ocean.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
So it's going to be kind of a precedent-setting exhibition at the Anchorage Museum because it's combining science and art. And I'd have to say it also involves kind of an environmental issue. And we've got the director of the museum, and we've got the science curator, and we've got one of the artists with us. I'm going to start with the artist because she's getting ready for the exhibition. You've got a piece in there. So welcome to the show, Karen Larson.
Thanks.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay.
So tell me what I'm going to see that will distinguish your piece.
Well, I went on, oh, I guess we'll talk a little bit about it later, but I went on the expedition. And so, creating works from trash hasn't been my medium, although I've done more like environmental kind of pieces. But,
I read a book by Julie Decker one time and it seemed like every Alaska artist makes stuff out of trash.
Yeah.
Okay. So you were not one of those, but still.
But yeah, I guess I went on the expedition to like actually kind of absorb all that was going on and like learn a lot from like a lot of the scientists and people that are kind of in that field a little bit more and
right.
Just kind of come in with a little bit of a fresh eye. And I started being really interested in the microplastics, which is the little bits and pieces that, you know, when you do beach cleanups, you can't really even get those. And those are going to be around for a ridiculously long time. And our beaches are becoming transformed by them. And you know, I mean, comparison to the beaches here, then, you know, is let's say, like, I bet spent some time in Asia, and, like, their beaches are pretty trash, too, you know, everywhere, it's in Hawaii. But you start looking at the sand, and you start seeing a lot of, investigating it, and seeing a lot more things in there than just sand. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So how does art come out of that?
Well, you'll just have to go see.
Oh, come on. Give me more than that, please.
Well, I guess I'm a little bit interested in how that's starting to get into our food chain, too. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, that's kind of, I mean, us as a subsistence kind of lifestyle, I think that's a real issue for us in Alaska and, I mean, worldwide. I mean, mm-hmm. It's something, and we're starting to lose the track of where everything kind of comes from. And everyone likes to, you know, everyone, it's like a complacency and convenience kind of thing. And so, yeah, start realizing that our small actions can do some big things. And if everyone starts doing these small actions, maybe something we can start a little bit of a shift.
Wow.
But
well, now I'm just really curious because I have absolutely no idea why I was none. All right, but I'm gonna quit pressing. and turn to Julie Decker. You're director of the museum, but I think you are also the curator of the show, right?
Yeah, the show actually started as a project almost 3 years ago. We were approached by Howard Farron, who was then the director of conservation for the Alaska Sea Life Center, and was really one of the first people in Alaska speaking the language of marine debris, and approached us about having a co-project with the Sea Life Center where they would work on launching an expedition that would bring artists and scientists to Alaska shorelines to see that even in this very remote and what we think of as a very pristine environment, there is trash washing up on our shores. And then the museum jumped in as a collaborator and launched this exhibition. But as with many museum projects, they're years in the making. So you start with research and a thought and an idea, and then you go out and you find the experts to talk about it and the artists who might explore it. So.
Well, I was really excited that Carl Savino was involved because, you know, he's been a guest on this show a couple of times and has a special interest in Alaska, as you well know. Mm-hmm. And so he was one of the scientists aboard on this expedition. I guess I'll turn to Greg Danner here to get a little bit better idea of what actually happened in terms of an expedition.
Well, actually, I didn't participate in the expedition, but I am dealing with what came out of it. I was brushing a lot of that microplastic off of me earlier this morning as we were preparing the last stages of the exhibit. But one of the biggest things that came out of it, I think, was the opportunity for the artists and the scientists to share perspective and to be there together looking at that same environment, seeing it from sort of two slightly different but not antagonistic viewpoints, one of maybe one of expression and another one of investigation, and recognizing that there's a lot of overlap. There's a lot of overlap between that because you've got to observe at the root of all of that. So one of the things that I think Gyre really is going to provide for people as an exhibit, whether their own particular viewpoint is more artistic or more historical, scientific, whatever it may be, they're going to be able to come in and observe. They're going to really get a chance to see what the marine debris looks like. They're going to see what can be done with it, and they can also see what it's doing here to the coast of Alaska.
Well, I was shocked because when Fukushima happened, mm-hmm. We started hearing that, oh, it's already washing up on Montague Island.
Right.
And it was. The windborne stuff came through first. Mm-hmm. And it was, but it turned out that it's very hard to tell the Fukushima stuff from the stuff that is always washing up there. And there are certain places in Alaska, and any pilot who flies the coast can tell you that this stuff is always showing up there because of where we are in the gyre.
Right. Absolutely, yeah.
So this one, this trip was Hallow Bay, I understand?
Hallow Bay, yeah.
It was throughout South Central Alaska. It was a six-day trip, artisan scientists on board, and it wasn't a long journey in terms of mileage, but I think the idea was to show people that in a very accessible part of Alaska's environment, there's a large amount of trash to be found. And as you said, it's not based on natural disasters. It doesn't just come from tsunamis and other natural events. This is a man-made problem. It's a modern problem. It came with largely with our advent of plastics. So we can look at the last 50 years as having helped us create this problem. And in Alaska, the color of Alaska's beaches and beaches all over the world has changed. Now it's a multicolored environment of these multicolored plastics.
Years ago, I got to know an archaeologist who was originally from University of Arizona, but he was in Pittsburgh when I knew him as Jim Adivasio, and he's the guy that started kids, graduate students, excavating landfills, and it was a simple category, just as you would do an archaeological site, a midden heap, you know, it's just old garbage, really, and going through there and taking all the different forms of tabs from the beer cans, you know, arranging them and doing that. And there's almost a temptation for that. That's why I'm so fascinated with what you're doing, Karen, because you are deliberately going for the stuff that's very hard to see.
Yeah, well, I mean, I couldn't collect on the trip enough of what I needed for material. So I actually kind of tapped some of the, a couple of the people that were on the trip and connected me to a woman out in Craig that was, she does cleanups, you know, she's like, there's a couple of really amazing individuals around the state that just, they have a passion for collecting and going to very remote places and cleaning up beaches and, you know, and then they live out, you know, to get rid of this stuff. I mean, this woman, Colleen, who lives in a fog, off in Fog Neck.
She may call.
Yeah. I just saw her yesterday at the Environment, Alaska Forum and the Environment Conference. But, you know, I mean, she's just started, you know, getting some money from nonprofits to pay for her gas to do this. But it's just her passion, you know, and it's amazing. And so anyway, this woman, Kathy Peavy in Craig, she has one of these beaches that collects a lot of the microplastics. And different beaches, just because of their terrain, you know, you don't see that. But it's in the ocean. It just has to surface somewhere.
She knows. I mean, beachcombers start knowing things like this. Yeah.
You know, and so like a lot of the beaches we went on were really rocky or grassy that you can't really, unless you ripping out grass, that you're really going to collect that. But certain beaches, it's just like just covered. And so she would just send me shoveled boxes of trash, basically. Uh-huh. And yeah, so I was, collecting enough material, the right kind and what I wanted and sorting. And yeah, you find a lot of interesting stuff too.
And Karen's piece is inspired by her upbringing in Wisconsin, which I think is an interesting story, thinking about how food was collected prior to plastics. I don't know if you want to tell that story, Karen.
Well, just like, I mean, I grew up on a dairy farm and, you know, a large garden. And I, you know, I just started thinking about, like, when did really we have a bunch of plastic in our house, you know? And I was like, I can remember, like, the few Tupperware pieces that my mom maybe got at a party, you know? But I was like, you know, we got our milk from the cows and our meat from the cows. And you start, like, you're like, and then you're like, well, I guess the 2-liter bottles of soda maybe started coming a little bit into the household. And then, yeah, I mean, it was just interesting how we've kind of lost that. Like, you know, so we buy little individual yogurt containers and little, you know, everything's individualized. But it's like all that's just disposable plastic and we're continuing to use more and more of it. And
yeah. Well, I grew up born and raised right next to a dairy, and the trucks would come in the morning from the farms with the big, you know, those big cans on there, and you'd hear them clunking around. I mean, when I get up in the morning, that was the sound that, and then they would process that in the dairy right next door, and at the front of our house, in the front porch, there was a little rack, and that's where the milk bottles went. You put the empties out there, and you got full ones back. Mm-hmm. It's all very simple. There's no plastic involved at all. Yeah, very interesting. So, yeah, but I think, don't microplastics actually really enter the food chain? I mean, right through the digestive systems of animals? I mean, when they get smaller, they got to be part of what they eat.
Yeah.
Because they're so abundant.
Well, even large plastics enter the food system. You have sharks eating large objects and birds eating bottle cap sized pieces and then all the
lighters.
Way down from
you know.
Yeah. And all the way down to microorganisms, and we don't know how they're digesting or adapting to plastics.
I have not seen the exhibition at all, so all my impressions I'm getting from you or from what I've seen somewhere. But somewhere I did see a picture of the contents of an albatross's stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't believe it.
It's one of the stories, and I think a number of artists have been attracted to that because it's so compelling visually. But Midway Atoll in the Pacific Ocean, tiny island, has been attracting scientists and artists for a variety of reasons for a number of years. And the albatross that populate that island are being devastated by plastic pollution. The female albatross to feed their young. They go fly out and look for food, and they're mistaking plastic for food. These are colorful items floating in the water. It looks like great fish or other things that an albatross would eat. They eat that. The mother eats that, comes back, regurgitates it for their baby. The baby is then fed plastic. And now there are corpses of these birds throughout Midway, and the natural body of the bird will deteriorate, but the stomach contents, which are full of plastic, remain. So there are these very compelling images of the stomach contents of these birds that are left behind.
I don't think even Rachel Carson saw that one coming. I really don't. It's hard for these unintended consequences way beyond what anyone could have imagined.
It's something of a cruel irony, because the same currents that bring what should be the food for those birds to the surface and allow the, often animals like krill to thrive are the same currents that bring the plastic and to those same areas, concentrate it, bring it to the surface. And so we're really displacing the food and replacing it with plastic, and the result is that the birds are not succeeding.
What a scary thing to say. the Exxon Valdez oil spill and the story of the outer coast of the Kenai Peninsula. And I worked this story pretty hard with the people down there in Seldovia and the fishermen coming out of Homer, and they knew where that oil was going to go. They knew it was going to go to Gore Point, and they knew that this is also like really critical habitat, and they were just scared what's going to happen to our fish when this stuff starts piling up there. And it did, and nobody would listen to them. And it did. Right. It all showed up, because that's another one of those spots where stuff just...
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the gyre brings it in.
The gyre brings it in. You've got more currents really in the ocean than I think most of us can keep in our brains at any one time.
Oh, yeah. And then they change.
And they change. And they fluctuate with the seasons. They fluctuate with temperature and all of these other factors. And so we do know that there are places on the planet. There are places like Hawaii. There are places like Halo Bay that just tend to be the spot that, however everything else changes, that's where the trash ends up.
Let's go to Bob, joins the program from Soldotna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob.
Greetings from Soldotna. I was listening to something popped into my head about iconic painting of Andy Warhol, the Campbell soup can. And then another expression, I think, from back in the 70s and 80s, about better living through modern chemistry. And this is what we're facing now. The Sargasso Sea, we have kind of that out here in the currents. I've seen film of it where it's just a big area where the currents come together, and it's just kind of a doldrum, where there's all these little chips of plastic floating everywhere and everything. And, it's sad to see this stuff coming and compiling, as you say, in the mire, or the, I can't remember the word you used, Steve, the...
Gyre.
Gyre, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's the name of the exhibition.
Yeah. Well, I think of the things that we can't see that I heard mentioned, like the oil underneath the sand and rocks in Prince William Sound. And also, you had a show here a couple weeks ago about Fukushima, I heard you mentioned. And I was thinking also of other places. During the time of the Cold War, when everybody was at hands building nuclear weapons, and our neighbors to the west of us here in Russia, Soviet Union, they were piling all their cesium-135 into old wells under piles of rocks. I guess our satellites can pick it up because it decays in an upward fashion. But it goes up and it comes back down. I'm not an artist myself, but I can see a painting of glowing raindrops. We all know that we've been getting acid rain from these industrialized countries to the west of us. And there are so many unseen things that are affecting our environment, our food, on land and in the ocean. And And you mentioned plastic getting into the, our food system. Well, yeah, I understand that women have small amounts of plastic in their breast milk. You know, where have we come with this? You know, this is...
Well, I don't think you can quite metabolize it out like that, but I guess molecules on the molecular level, some could happen.
Yeah, well, I've heard, I heard that, I believe, on Frontline on a show some time ago.
Wow, really? Yeah, well, yeah. Greg is nodding his head here. Mm-hmm.
One of the smaller messages that we're going to be sharing with folks in Gyre as an exhibit is, you know, what is plastic? What is it made of? And without going into a huge chemistry lesson, plastics all share a few common properties. They're made of these small molecules, and we refer to those as monomers. In order to get a material that we can use as a cup, as a rain jacket, or as anything else, we combine those small molecules into long chains or sheets, and those are called polymers. So even though we can take those plastics and we can put them in a landfill, we can do a lot of different things with them, unless we chemically attack the polymers, even when they break down, when they erode on the beach and they become the microplastics, when we send them into a landfill, they break down, they go back to monomers, but at that point they are still plastic, and that is still the material that might make its way into any part of our food chain.
I know the city of Homer was very concerned with this, and they banned the use of plastic shopping bags down there.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we always look to Homer for that type of leadership.
Well, I guess there's some concern about it, and you know, I guess these plastic shopping bags and how they make so they degrade when they're exposed to sunlight.
Some of them.
And, I'm not sure about that for sure, but yeah, I'm glad to, and thank you for taking my call we need to all be environmentally conscious.
Well, thanks for coming to the table, Bob.
Thank you. You have a good day.
Yeah, you too. Let's go to Rick. Joins the program from Little Tutka Bay. Hi, Rick. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi. Thank you for the program. It's great, and this is a great subject. In fact, the sad thing is that our KBBI radio station just went off the air about 5 minutes ago.
Oh, darn it.
We'll replay it at another
time. Here I am insulting them, and they can't even hear me.
That's right. Well, that's probably a good thing. Now they love you. Yeah, you know, this is a great subject, and I could go on and on, because actually I have an eco-tour business, and I couldn't go with listening to this program without calling in and putting in my 2 cents worth, but... you know, it's amazing what people don't realize that help to pollute the oceans, you know, because they just throw the garbage out into it. But, you know, I caught a halibut. Actually, a guest of mine had caught a halibut, and there was a beer can in its belly. Oh. And the beer can appeared that it had been thrown over whole or barely crushed, but inside of the stomach of the halibut, the stomach had been working, and it actually was ripping and tearing the stomach cavity. The fish was underweight because it hadn't eaten for some time, and or was not processing its food. But the thing is that they'll swallow something like that, and it actually does kill off, you know, our fishes. And then the other thing is, I'm a diver, so. There's a lot of plastic. So when I was in Costa Rica, I couldn't believe in the playas, the bays there, the beaches, that how much plastic sank to the bottom. And so what you see above floating in the water and that's floated to the beach, there's a lot that's down at the bottom that is our trash too. So, you know, it's something to bear in mind. Another reason why to keep, you know, this garbage off the beaches, out of the waters, and everybody do their part. And what we encourage is if you're going out anywhere, it doesn't matter if it's on land or on the beaches, and like we do a kayaking tour every day, you know, we'll have our bags in stored away. So if we need to, we fill up. We're always bringing back garbage. Our guests actually say, comment on how clean our beaches are, but we actually monitor several miles of beaches, you know, in the area that we...
They're clean because we go out there and clean them up. That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah, do your part, but have something to carry the garbage back in. And if you find something bigger, because heaven knows we've
you know, run into the refrigerator that was thrown out there, couches, you know, big stuff. And so we'll carry those above the high tide mark and then come back and get them with a skip later on. And so it makes just a huge difference, and then just ignore it and say, well, gosh, look, somebody threw that out there. Isn't that terrible?
It's so beautiful here, but what is it with that couch over there?
Yeah, it is amazing, you know, the stuff that we do find out there. And thank God that the cruise ships have been restricted on throwing their garbage out. You wouldn't believe the stuff we used to find, you know, the outdated hams in the packages and milk cartons full of milk and never even cracked open. But now we don't find so much of that anymore.
Oh, man, you're opening my eyes, Rick. Thanks.
Yeah, well, you know, I just think this is a great, it's always going to be a struggle to try to stay abreast of all the pollution that we're putting out there, but you know, we can all do our part, and it does make a difference. And so you know, I just want to say one last thing before I bow out so you can carry on with other people's comments, but you know, if you have those plastic holders that hold your cans of soda pop or whatnot, juices, cut up anything that has a ring in it, netting, because there's a lot of birds and mammals that get caught up in that, and it's just a horrid way to, you know, suffer and die. So anyways, there you go. Thank you so much for the program. Thank you to your guests, and come on out and play in the beaches.
Thanks a lot, Rick. Yeah, I'll remember that. Open the circle. Don't close the circle. Open the circle.
Yeah.
Very good.
Thank you so much.
Well, Greg, maybe you can tell me that you might know. What's this about plastic sinking? I guess obviously it sinks.
Right. We tend to think, you know, of plastics. Most of the plastics that we use are cast into relatively thin layers, and we hold things in them. We might hold water inside of a disposable bottle. We might have a tub of yogurt, that sort of thing. So the density of most of those plastics is pretty low. So they float. But we do make some high-density plastics, things that we don't necessarily use in the disposable culture, stuff that might be on a tool, for instance. If you think about the casing that goes around something like an electric saw, those are more dense. And so those actually can be more dense than the water, the seawater. But what really tends to happen is that over time, with the wave action and the plastic getting broken up, it picks up, it becomes more porous so that water actually enters it and makes it again more dense so that it can sink. Also, we can have organisms that will actually populate it. They'll start to grow on its surface and again make it heavier, and now it starts to sink to someplace in the water column or possibly all the way to the bottom.
Sometimes these things can be kind of pretty when they get some barnacles and such on them, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I grew up in Florida, of all the craziest places to grow up, and live here in Alaska. But, you know, even in the early 70s, finding a piece of plastic with some incredible life on it at the beach in Florida was unfortunately a common part of my childhood.
Yeah.
I think that's where the artists come in, too. I mean, I think there's this odd color palette that they're drawn to, and it's the contrast between this beautiful piece of glass on this natural beach. And so there are some, you know, beautiful images that artists are creating and are naturally drawn to this color and these objects for their visual qualities. But you know, they use that beauty to call attention to the ugliness that that they represent.
Yeah, that is a great observation. You know, just that you see that pattern in common, that because they are different colors. Right.
It's very compelling.
Nature,
I mean,
nature has a very subtle palette.
That faded color of plastic, when plastic's floating on the surface, it creates just a whole new set of pastels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really neat finding like a bottle, and the outside would be like this faded, like almost white kind of yellow. And then you look inside and it's bright yellow, you know, and you're just like, wow, you know, the sun and the water is really taking its toll on this thing.
Don't stop. And I love beach glass. I don't know about you, but it's beach glass. It's cool stuff. All right, down to Ketchikan and Lisa. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Lisa.
Hi. So I do have a question for your guests of kind of what are the neat things that you found on the beach. I wish I could see the exhibit, but I'm on the other side of the state. But it'd be really cool to be able to see all the artwork, but just all the beach combing that they have done? Like, what are your interesting things that you found?
Well, I mean, from, like, the places that we went, we kind of went, like, well, I mean, like, I guess it's, like, in the context of the expedition. I mean, we found, like, one of those big, like, just, you know, it's probably the size of your kitchen table of strapping packaging, just like a nest of white, you know, that white strapping from shipping stuff. And, you know, when you see that, you're like, wow. Or, you know, I'm sure you get it down there. But some of the nets that are so engrossed and embedded in the sand that you're like, there's no way you could even, you know, even think about trying to get it out of there. Or, yeah.
I think one of the things that...
Oh, sorry, Lisa, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, you see all that kind of stuff. You can't even pull the netting out of the sand. It's been wrapped around 20 logs, and it's on the other side of the beach and under your feet, and it's just ridiculous.
I started collecting these little Nerf little basketballs. They're about the size of your fist, maybe a little bit bigger, but I collected them on every beach.
Whoa.
You know, and then there's also the fly swatters that were, they're football kind of.
Every NFL team represented in the ocean.
Yeah. So, like, you know, container ship has, like, lost its container just distributed these all over. And so, yeah, I mean, I think different parts of the world will get different things depending upon where that container was. But yeah, these little Nerf balls, I collected probably like 20 of them, you know, and it was just like, oh, here's another one, you know. But yeah, and then like a lot of the little nurdles, which is like they're the little beads that they make pet bottles out of. And so at some point they used to have open containers, so you find lots of those if you start looking.
Nurdles.
They're called nurdles. They're just little pieces of plastic, and that's how they use that to form many of them to form plastic pet bottles, like the recyclable ones.
Oy,
we have some nurdles. Artists who have become beach collectors in a whole new way. So they collect things and then they end up sorting them. So we have one artist who's collected dozens of bread tabs and arranged them in a work of art, and or hair clips, or child's toys, toy soldiers. I mean, the list of objects is endless.
This is becoming some kind of weird natural history thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it really does. It has that flavor of all the scallops, say, of the Mediterranean as a comparative board, but now it's bread package clips. Right. Yeah.
Well, we've got plenty more as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. The Alaska Sea Life Center will host the 5th annual Alaska Marine Gala on Saturday, February 15th at the Denina Center in Anchorage. The evening will include live and silent auctions, dinner, dancing, and a presentation by UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences Dean, Dr. Mike Castellini. More information about sponsorship and tickets for this event can be found at alaskasealife.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Sea Life Center.
Take art, you take science, you take marine pollution and marine conservation, put them all together and you get something called Gyre, an exhibition that is opening at the Anchorage Museum this weekend. Julie Decker is the curator of and also now the director of the museum. Any chance this show might travel and then our Ketchikan caller might be able to get a look at it at some point?
Oh, we do intend to put this show on the road. We like it as an Alaska story, partly because of that perception that Alaska is the last pristine place on Earth. But when you take a closer look, maybe not so much. So we will develop a smaller version of the exhibition and send it to places in Alaska and outside.
Cool. Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. We had an email comment from Patty, who first said, I wish you wouldn't call it Fukushima debris. You could say tsunami debris. It scares people. And then she chimed in. She said, look, the number one piece of marine debris is cigarette butts. Is that true?
Is it the number one? I believe it is.
Wow.
I believe it is the most common one. And when
well, now,
they go out and do the beach
everything
cleanup,
but the filter is going to just go
exactly
down to
right
dust pretty quick there.
But the filters,
but all those filters.
Yeah, the filter's plastic. And the filter's plastic fibers, and they persist in the environment. Really, we have estimates of how long this stuff sticks around, but it's all estimates. It's really extrapolation, you know, and so we can easily say that they're going to be there for decades and in all likelihood considerably longer.
So in what form would one find that on the beach?
I think in order to, you know, to have that statistic that it's the most frequently found object, they have to be recognizable. They have to be there and still have that somewhat cylindrical shape to them and, you know, be basically the right length and size. We find lots of fibers on the beach of different plastics, and some of them come from things like monofilament fishing line. Others may be broken off of fishing nets and other equipment that goes to the sea. But the, you know, we've all seen enough cigarette butts in parking lots and probably in front yards and everything else that they're pretty easy to identify when you're all on the beach.
And they're going to go down a drain at some point, and they're going to end up in a water course, you know, unless they get skimmed out at some treatment plant, which in Alaska is unlikely.
I also think it brings up the point that this is a new study. It's a contemporary problem, and therefore the data is new also. So there are a number of agencies out there trying to determine, you know, what are the breakdown rates of plastics in the ocean and what is found. And I think what is found varies from beach to beach.
Let's go to Craig joins Stu. Sorry, Stu joins the program from Muldoon. Got confused with Doug from Craig there, Stu. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Stu. Good to have you back on.
Thanks, Steve. Styrofoam. I'm assuming it's a plastic. Have a lot of problems with it in a freshwater environment because so many people have docks, and of course you find it blown way inland, often on the beaches. I was just wondering, are there any special problems with styrofoam as opposed to other plastics, assuming it is a plastic?
Well, I will say I know it, that it's like was all over the place when Annie made that trip down to Montague Island. I mean, just like there was just these little beads of it all over the place there. But, go ahead.
The styrofoam is absolutely a plastic. There are different types of materials that become foam, but polystyrene is one of the most common that becomes the foam. It's a pretty simple molecule when it starts off, so to speak, at the factory, but by the time it's been processed and cast into the thousands of shapes that we use it in, there's no telling what it will appear like. The biggest thing that happens with the polystyrene is that it floats. It gets everywhere. It breaks apart quite easily when it's exposed to sunlight. It photodegrades so that it becomes brittle and breaks down into what Karen was talking about, the microplastics. And those are the bits and pieces that most easily enter the food chain. At least at the base of the food chain where we have our smallest organisms, things like shrimp and krill, are going to have a hard time telling the difference between a little bit of semi-transparent floating plastic and the little semi-transparent organisms that they regularly eat.
Stu?
Yeah. Well, Steve, you might want to do a show sometime on freshwater lakes in Alaska. So many people have docks still made out of styrofoam, and the muskrats love to dig in them.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Stu.
Thank you.
Great. Always great to hear from Stu. Down in Bethel now. Helen, welcome to Talk of Alaska, Helen.
Thank you. This is for taking my call. I've been studying our fish. We have the king salmon, Chinook, the coho silver salmon, the sockeye salmon, the red salmon, the pink salmon, which is also chum, and another chum salmon is also dog salmon. In order for the fish to spawn, they have, when the female lay eggs, they do it in very fresh water, and the males then lay their sperm on the eggs, and that's how they spawn and become fish. And Asia has only like cherry salmon, and another one is Satakimachu salmon. We're the only one that has all these different salmons that were derivative from rainbow trout, the steelhead salmon. Trout. I wanted to reiterate what that guy said about plastic and plastic pop holders. And what I notice is a lot of people throw old nets and bicycles and even cars and rusty, you know, trash that go on the bottom, and they're changing the ecosystem of, you know, the what's living on the bottom, the plants they derive. There's different species. I wanted to talk a little about climate change. The water is melting in the Arctic and the glaciers very fast, and water is accumulating and the ocean is growing. But it wouldn't be natural because the temperature and the fish won't be used to the differences in the climate of the water. And there's so many different things that are happening to our fish here, and that's our most vital asset resource here in Alaska. And that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ellen. Thank you for that examination of the various aspects of what can happen to salmon. Let's go to Craig, and Doug joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Doug.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for this show. I've been trying to find a way to thank some of these people in Craig that have been doing all this. Kathy Peavy, I heard her name mentioned earlier. She's got a crew of several ladies here that are tireless on the beach cleanup, and then they not only do they clean it up, then they sort through it all, and then I guess they picked out a lot of that micro debris I know they sent up north. But
an artist that wanted it for some crazy reason that she won't tell us.
Kathy had a table in her yard loaded with all that little stuff, picking through for interesting things, I guess, to ship off. But anyway, I have a fishing boat down here, and I have hauled in a bunch of the debris. And these guys, like I said, they're working so hard on these beaches, and we are seeing a difference. I just was commenting the other day that this one beach that they have been picking up for several years in a row is looking so clean. It's just not like it used to be. So that's just I just think that they need to be recognized probably for all the work that they do. And you know, and once in a while too, when they're picking up all this stuff, you find something good. You get a new gaff hook out of the deal. I have a Detroit Red Wings fly swatter on my boat now, so, you know, we got a few things that that are good that way too. And and also I'd like to can we get this show 2 times a week maybe?
I made a bid for that when they discontinued Talk of the Nation, but it didn't go very far. I went, once I presented the budget, that was the end of the discussion. Yeah.
Well, it's a great show. Thank you.
All right, Doug. thanks for that call. And I love when we make connections like that. So she didn't call, but this guy called. He said, well, she had it all laid out on the table. Find the best little bits for you. Just so you know. So are we going to see these fly swatters somewhere in the exhibition, Julie?
We don't have any fly swatters.
No
in the
fly swatters.
They weren't very inspiring.
No, that's not true. We do have fly swatters.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, we do actually. One of the pieces that I've been overseeing is an interactive exhibit where folks will get to touch the trash, because of course with the artworks you may be able to recognize it, but you can't touch it. And so we actually have a little small collection of the fly swatters, and people can touch them. They can pick them up. They can find out more about them. So, yeah, there are a few fly swatters.
So that does that overflow into the Imaginarium, or is that right there with the...
It's right there in Gyre. We've got some stuff that's overflown into the Imaginarium as well. Our ever-popular tsunami tank is also going to get some marine debris to let people observe just how that behaves when they create their tsunamis.
Well, that's great.
Yeah. So we've got a little bit of overflow.
We're talking to Greg Danner. He's science curator at the Anchorage Museum. Julie Decker is the director of the museum and curator of Gyre. And Karen Larson is an artist who has done a piece that will be in the exhibition that is opening this weekend. How long is it going to be up?
Almost 6 months through August.
6 months. Yeah. So this will be the one for the tourists.
Tourists will get to experience the story as well.
I wonder how ABCB feels about that.
Well, I think one of the things we want to do is not just raise awareness of the problem and the issue, but to raise awareness of how individuals can actually make an impact. So while humans created the problem, humans can also make a difference in cleaning up our beaches and recycling and limiting single-use plastics. So we don't want to leave with a hopeless message. We leave people with a message of empowerment that we can do something about this problem.
Single-use plastics. Mm-hmm. Right, we got some big pieces in this show?
There are some big installations, absolutely. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I've seen, I think it was the Dave Gaudette's organization, mm-hmm. I think there were some people in Homer that sponsored a deal where you made art out of those. They made some fantastic things. Big ones. Big ones. And you had to get out. They were beautiful. When you had to get up close before you realized what they were made of.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. One of our artists, takes a 30 feet of wall space to show how what a range of plastics there are in the ocean. So from small to big, she gives an example of things that she found on Alaska's coastline.
Well, we got a few minutes left. 1-800-478-8255 is the phone number in Anchorage. A local call at 550-8422. And email is talk@alaskapublic.org. We're talking about art entering the dialogue about marine conservation as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Whether it has to do with fishing, food, or fun, every Alaskan has a story about their connection with wild salmon. And you're invited to hear some of those stories. Introducing Salmon Voices, a new series from the Salmon Project. It features Alaska authors, photographers, and illustrators sharing their experiences with Alaska's most famed fish. New stories will be published each day, February 2nd through the 16th, on AlaskaDispatch.com. This message is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
And very apropos, this is a question for Greg Danner from Michael, who says, what plastic things should consumers most avoid buying to help cut back on plastic pollution in the ocean? I guess cigarettes with filters.
I'm going to nod to Julie because I think she gave me the answer beforehand, which is those single-use plastics, those things that we buy and know that we're going to use them for a day or less, and then we throw them into our waste stream. And they persist in the landfill, they persist in the environment, wherever they end up, for quite a long time. Folks are aware, of course, that a lot of the plastic shopping bags that we receive now have been changed to what's called as photobiodegradable, which basically means, as far as the industry is concerned, that if you let it come into contact with the soil, you let it come into contact with some moisture, and you give it some sunlight, that it will break down and start to decompose. But of course, when those things end up in the waters, whether that's in our fresh waters with the salmon, or whether they go directly into the ocean, those are not the conditions anymore. They're not in contact with the soil. They're not going to have the amount of sunlight striking them that's necessary. So if we can, all of us, take whatever steps to reduce those plastics that we only intend to use one time, it'll make a definite positive impact on what ends up in the ocean.
Bring your own bag.
Exactly.
Huh.
Refill your water bottle.
And let's see, I don't want to miss this one. Oh, yeah, Mary Beth says, a friend of mine, Lena Klaus in Hong Kong, is creating amazing art from found debris and using it to help educate the public. She displays her art on the beach and in the water drains of the beaches and villages around Hong Kong check out her work. Inspiring.
It's cool. Well,
nice.
Great. I like going to the beach is great. Seeing art made on the beach, even if it's just a sand sculpture, is really great.
Mm-hmm.
Really great. You know, it's like somehow when we don't acknowledge that we are a part of nature, we're kind of missing something, I think. And here is Sally and Jeff, recently returned from a few days on ADAC. Huge wads of fishing floats, nylon cordage, netting tangled with wood, and a host of other junk. With the remoteness of ADAC, I marveled at the crap that undoubtedly survived many months drifting way out in the Gulf of Mexico, the Gulf of Alaska, before bumping ashore. Made all too real the threat to marine life as the carcass of something looking vaguely like a beluga was being picked apart by the Congress of Eagles. What a bloody mess. Thanks again.
I think, you know, Alaska has a distinct problem in addressing marine debris. It's, you know, in places in California, you can access the beach fairly easily. You can clean up in a day. You can remove it. You can bring things to recycling centers. In Alaska, we have these inaccessible remote beaches that are hard to get to. Once you clean it up, how do you get it off the beach? We have unique situations of entanglement of nets. I mean, from the water, the beach may look clean, but it's just behind that shoreline that you find most of the debris because it's tangled up in grass and tangled up in bushes, and extracting the trash can be a project in itself. So it's not an easy solution or an easy task.
Well, I think, Dave Gaudette, who was would have been on the show, except he had to be at the Alaska Forum instead, would probably also have a multitude of ideas for this emailer said, I want to know ways I can get involved and clean up. Because there is that, okay, so you go there, and then you're going to carry all that stuff back. I mean, some of it's big.
Well,
and who would pick it up if you didn't?
I mean, I think Karen can talk about on the expedition there was beach cleanup efforts, and then we had to use small boats to take the trash to big boats and use cranes off a boat to get the trash back onto the shore.
Cranes?
Well, in Halo Bay, because of in Katmai, they actually, I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago, they tried to do a big beach cleanup effort. They bagged it all up, and it's really hard to land a craft. And then even to, you know, put it on a larger ship and get it out of there. And they had it bagged up from 2 years and they couldn't land the craft. So we were picking up even the cleanup efforts that were done this year, but we were also cleaning up previous years. And but yeah, it was a little sketchy at the first part. And everyone in the Park Service were like, they thought like they were like the first attempt of landing the craft to pick up it. They were like, oh my God, they couldn't get in. And they were like, oh my gosh, we're going to have now even more trash sitting here, you know? And then tourists come out there, you know, to Halo Bay, and they're like, what is this, you know? And so, but anyway, luckily we could land everything, and it ended up working out really pretty amazing. But yeah, craning and off boats and doing lots, and we had a lot of crew out there to move the trash. But
and Halo Bay was really striking because people go there for the wildlife. I mean, they go to the see the bears, and
it's pretty hard to get to.
It is. You can take a float plane and you land, and the bears are greeting the airplane. But you know what you see now are bears wandering among the plastic trash that make their way far beyond the ocean.
And some of the park rangers even were saying that, you know, some of the comments that people were leaving, it was like, well, this beach is like, there's tons of trash around, you know, and they're like, they're like kind of complaining, but it's like, this is a world problem, you know, and it's not like, you know, even for the park people to get that, you know, I mean, that's a lot. It's a huge beach, and there's a lot of trash up there that it's a collector.
Well, that's one of the reasons we called the exhibit Gyre, is to make the point that this is a global issue. This is not Alaska's trash washing up on Alaska shores. Some of it is, but a lot of it's coming from very far-flung places like Japan, and the gyres toss it around and send it to all kinds of different places. So it's a way we're connected globally that we may not want to be connected.
Reagan reminds us that in Anchorage, there's going to be a cleanup day. And it's going to be on June 22nd, and people that want to pitch in
absolutely
are welcome to do so. And they can email AnchorageCoastalCleanup coho@gmail.com for more information. You know, Karen, I want to ask you a little bit. When you start talking about your experiences here, I get the sense that this has really made a difference in your artistic views. And do you think you've changed through this?
I think you start really, I think I woke one night up on the boat and I was dreaming about plastic. I'm like, oh my gosh, I've been just like thinking about plastic all the time. But it starts to affect you and like what I can do in my household and my everyday use. And I mean, I'm also a graphic designer and I've been exploring some packaging design and like trying to have alternative. My partner grows microgreens and sprouts, and you know he's using clamshells, you know, the single use clamshells, and I'm like, we got to get rid of those, you know. What can we do here? And just looking at what else is out there, and it's like us as consumers, we have to start demanding some of these technologies and products that are a little bit more sustainable. So, yeah. There's a couple interesting options out there, but not, you know, like traveling around like India, like they use banana leaves to conform to little packagings and put your food in it. And people throw it out the train window and you're like, that's brilliant, you know? But it's like, what can we do here, you know? So.
Yeah. Well, we don't have banana leaves.
No, we don't. Yeah. Yeah. There's a couple of interest. There's some folks down in California that are trying to make packaging out of mushrooms, which is kind of interesting. And I know Method has created a plastic out of the gyre plastics and recycled it.
Huh.
I was trying to think of some of the other ones that we've been in contact with and trying to figure out.
So, Julia, I only got about a minute left, but I did want to ask you, because this is part of a larger thrust at the museum, what more can we expect?
I think our distinct environment offers us a lot of opportunities to look at ourselves and our place in the world and in the Arctic. We think combining art and science and history is a great opportunity to have broad-ranging conversations, and to have artists as part of that equation creates a really interesting opportunity for a very visual and compelling narrative. So we think there aren't divisions between disciplines that don't offer really great opportunities to have discussions. So artists will be part of our discussions moving forward about the environment and the place we live is, I think, one of the most interesting things about the museum and our future.
So I'm hearing probably more visiting artists, right? And probably more public engagement.
Oh, I hope so, yes.
Well, I thank all three of you so much for being with
us.
And I look forward to this exhibition. It's really exciting. And, you know, it's been fun to talk about it's really kind of a depressing subject. This has still been a fun show, and I thank all of you for that.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Kristen Platt and Josh Hedge and Monica Gokey, and I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.